This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 71, brought to you in association with Smart Pension, Synchron, and Archover. And I'm delighted to be joined by Faisal Hussain, CEO and co-founder of Synchron, to talk about the vital stage that the leading fintechs haven't yet mastered, going from being a scale-up to a growth company. If anyone can tell the tale of how to do that, it's Faisal, whose company has gone from being just an idea, quotes, in his head, unquotes, to today, where Synchron employs 7,000 people in 18 countries and generates $400 million worldwide. They've done this journey in under 16 years and phenomenally without any external capital whatsoever, which is amazing. It's a sign of their growth that a few episodes ago when I checked their stats, there were 6,000 people in 16 countries. So that's up 1,000 people in two countries in the past few months. I'm not sure whether textbooks draw the line in the sand between a scale-up and a growth company. Maybe Faisal can tell us later from his experiences how useful this whole startup to scale up to growth company model is in the first place and what it actually feels like from the inside. Are there real phase changes, such as one gets going from ice to water to steam? Or, like the Tao Te Ching's main angle, are these distinctions just mental lines in the sand that we humans draw in arbitrary places and perhaps academics get paid to debate forevermore? I started my career in what felt like a real startup. Three MDs who had second mortgaged their houses 6 months earlier to fund the venture. I was employee number 12, and the future was definitely not assured, all of which sounds rather like a startup to me. At that stage, you could know everyone well, and it was like a large family. It scaled up rapidly, and around 18 months later when I left the world of computers and the fresh air of Bath for the smoke of London and the heady whiff of merchant banking, the firm had got to over 50. At that point, I knew most names, but not all, relatively few people well, and there were always some folks coming and going who I was never quite sure what they did or who they were. So somewhere in there was a real face change, a real change of gear, and I guess for the MDs, at some point, they became unable to interview everyone personally, and that must have felt like a face change for them. There are quite a few good fintech scale-ups in London right now, but I think no real growth companies. No fintechs going global or achieving anything like the rocket trajectory that Synchron is on. So this story is rarer than diamonds. After all, diamonds are everywhere. So let's dive into the topic. How do you turn your startup or scale-up into a growth company? What are the methods? What are the pitfalls? Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi Faisal, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Mike. A pleasure to be here, and thank you for the generous words.
Yes, I always start with generous words and lull people into a false sense of security, you see. It lowers their guard. It makes it much easier to sort of get the retaliation in second rather than in first. Now, when I was asking your people what you actually sort of did in your spare time, given that you clearly don't really have much spare time, they did say that you play the guitar, which was interesting given how much travel you're doing. I mean, do you actually sort of pack a guitar and take it around the world, or do you practice the air guitar late at night in the hotel room?
Once upon a time, I did travel with a guitar, and I looked very funny at airports where I would be in a suit and tie with a laptop bag and a guitar on my back. So there was a time, but these days, no, I do not travel with my guitar. I do try to practice and learn. I'm a very amateur, very beginner stage with the guitar, but I practice when I'm not traveling and I'm home. In many ways, it is my true passion. If I could manage it, I would essentially dedicate all my time to music and guitar, but there are other priorities right now.
Yes, yes. We're talking guitars. I mean, I think it was last week, as part of my elder daughter's Christmas present, I went along to see Black Sabbath's final concert in London at the O2 Arena, which I hadn't been to before, actually, quite a large arena. And it was an extremely good show. And being from Birmingham, I knew of Black Sabbath when I was young, and I wasn't a great fan in the 70s. But actually, it's one of those groups whose albums have matured really well over time. And actually, as the decades have gone past, I've appreciated them more. And these guys have been going for 50 years. And as I'm sure you know, Tony Iommi, the lead guitarist of Black Sabbath, who kind of, in a way, invented heavy metal, was a phenomenal guitarist. I mean, the thing that struck me, I mean, as usual, there's a startup band whose main function is always in these situations is to be rubbish. And they were pretty rubbish. So when the main band come on, you think, oh, wow, they're much better. But the thing I noticed with them, and actually many other sort of modern so-called rock bands, is they're always putting their foot on pedals. And I quite like pedals because it changes the sound quite a lot. I'm into synthesizers, so I like different qualities of sound. But the interesting thing about Tony was that he played the entire two-hour set with roughly, off the top of my head, no pedal whatsoever.
Wow.
He just played the guitar, and it was amazing.
Amazing.
Yeah, so I'm really pleased to have gone that, actually. So everything changes, and I would never have imagined a few decades ago that I'd be pleased to be going to Black Sabbath, or indeed that they could all actually stand up well into their 60s, although Ozzy did actually have to lean on the microphone quite a lot for most of the gig. So that leads in quite nicely, actually, coincidentally. They've had their career journey over 50 years and the sort of rock and roll lifestyle. I'm glad to say that the lifestyle of a businessman and entrepreneur is less perilous to their health than theirs was. So how did you go from one day working in, quotes, real companies to thinking, oh, I'll go and do something crazy?
I think the story goes back to the late 90s, in the year 2000, when I was in New York working for a large investment bank and using a lot of large consultancies to get a lot of the work that the bank needed to do. And as a client, I was really struggling with the consulting firms, even though on paper their corporate resumes were very strong and they claimed that they had done pretty much everything that we could ever want for them to do. But when it came to the actual service delivery, there was a lot of gap. There was a gap in technical skills in Wall Street then and today. The level of technical sophistication, technical acumen is much more than, I guess, with other industries. And they were just not geared to that level of technical sophistication. They were not geared to working in a very agile environment of a trading floor. Today we have that word of agile. Earlier we didn't. But, you know, they were not very geared towards working in a fast-paced, unstructured environment of large banks, large investment banks. And the third is they lacked business skills. They really lacked business understanding of details of what happens in the front office, the middle office, the back office, the different asset classes, how they're structured. And as a client, we really struggled in engaging with them. So that's where the idea came of starting a consultancy that would have very high-end technical skills geared towards investment banks, towards trading firms, but also mixed with very deep business understanding skills. So equal sides of business and technical capabilities. That was the vision. Called up a couple of friends and asked them if they would be interested in leaving their comfortable jobs.
Were they married at the time? Did they have to get permission from their
wives? We were all married.
Oh dear.
Yes, we were all married, but just newly married.
Ah, okay.
No kids. So
oh, that's okay then.
In many ways, that was
the
good time to do it. And that's the background. It's been now 16 years since we made that decision.
And so the first box you've clearly ticked, which is that you were solving a known problem.
Yes, that I had experienced.
You had a problem, you had a headache, and not just you had a headache, but other people did as well. So there's the classic gap in the market. So you set out, and this is a brave journey, it is a brave journey to leave the solid paycheck and solid future path for the more entrepreneurial, the more exciting, but also the more challenging journey. So talking of the journey, I mentioned in the waffle in the introduction that there is this model called startup, scale up and growth. And like many things, all models are good as far as they go, and it's a kind of useful shorthand. But on the other hand, if you take it too literally, maybe it's sort of not helpful. So in terms of the 16 years, from your experience, how relevant are concepts like startup, scale-up and growth? Or you can destroy the whole episode, if you like, by saying completely irrelevant. I'll have to call it something else then.
I'm not sure it's completely irrelevant. There is something to that way of thinking about it, but I don't think it's as black and white as that. Yes, there is clearly a startup phase where you are just trying to achieve stable cash flows and a stable list of clients. And that for us was probably a one-year period or 18-month period where we were like that. But I think for us, and again, every company is different, but for us, we feel that we can never stop thinking like a startup. Our spirit has to be of a startup. And by that, I mean the agility, the quick decision-making, having communication from whoever's at the top to whoever's in the field to be as short and as quick as possible. Those are all elements of a startup. We cannot become, quote-unquote, corporate, where we spend our times in what I call analysis paralysis.
In internal meetings, talking
yes, internal
to yourself
meetings,
about yourself.
Yes, absolutely. So, and that's why I think we are successful, that all we have the size and the scale of a large company, 7,000 people, 18 countries, but the spirit is still of a startup.
Yes, it's interesting hearing you talk about that, because when you were talking, I was thinking it's a bit like the journey of life. It's a bit like, you know, one day you're a kid and you're having fun and just playing around, all that kind of stuff, and then you grow up and you get responsibilities and children and all this kind of stuff, and if you're not careful, it can weigh you down. But the best model is that at any age you can still relate to the childlike wonder of the world.
Yes.
And the ability to play and be creative and have fun and just enjoy things and not take it too seriously, as if you're burdened by it all. You know, if sort of family and children and 7,000 staff become a burden on you, it can actually end up being something that you don't enjoy. And talking about music beforehand, there are a lot of people who kind of lose the creativity because, in a sense, they've lost their contact with themselves when they were young.
Yes.
You see 4-year-olds, you give them some sand and some water and some paint, they'll play with it.
Yes.
They'll have fun, and so one needs to retain that. Okay, so I take that point, which is a good one, which is that you must always be a startup. I mean, before Christmas, Blue Motor Finance, who one of my joint winners of my FinTech of the Year award last year, a chap called Bob Jones, who's 75, and was at the first concert the Beatles ever had with Ringo playing for them, he was telling us his secrets of how he's been so successful. And in his case, success means making a large 7-figure profit after 2 years as a FinTech, which is phenomenal in London. The average FinTech of any age makes none. And one of his mentalities was always to have constant renewal. I caricature it slightly, but every 2 years you look yourselves in the mirror and say, well, all our IT must be out of date and rubbish. How can we all change it? You know, just constant revolution kind of stuff, rather than ever getting locked into something. So I take the point that you need to maintain some of the ethos of a startup, not turn into some sort of organogrammitis company talking about yourselves internally, not some kind of civil servicey bureaucracy. So abstracting from those words, though, as I said earlier, there must be these faint changes. When there were, you know, you and your two buddies, your first employee, I'm sure you all interviewed him.
Yes.
And the second and the third and the fourth. But at a certain point of time, you no longer could interview everybody, yes, for example. And at a certain point of time, you recruited people who recruited people, or maybe recruited people who recruited people who recruited people, for all I know. I mean, what is that experience from the inside? I mean, it must be a little bit going like kids again. You sort of let them go to the shops on their own for the first time and hope they don't get mugged or they go off to university or these kind of things.
I think we've gone through all of those phases. At one point in time, I took great pride in saying that I know everybody's names and their stories and their families and the company. That didn't last very long, the way we were growing. And then, like you correctly said, there was a phase where I was interviewing every individual, especially all the technical staff that we were bringing on. But I think in that way, we were mature in recognizing at what points we needed to delegate that to other people. And this is where leadership becomes very, very crucial. The way I look at our company and others is, if the leadership is right, then a lot of the people who are under the leaders will also be right. But if we get the leadership wrong, then, for example, in recruitment, when we delegated the recruitment decisions that I used to make, for example, to others, I made sure that I could trust the leaders to make those decisions. That doesn't mean that everything would be perfect. There were issues where nobody could have sort of foreseen what eventually happened. But the question is, do we learn from that and do we make changes? I think we've been very mature in that. I would like to think that at Synchron, we do have a very strong, you can almost say, family culture. At one point, I knew everybody. Today, absolutely, I cannot even claim to say that I know maybe even half the number of people. It is 7,000 people. But the point is, I do try to make an effort. So whenever I'm traveling in whatever location, the days are usually filled with client meetings and business, but the evenings are always reserved for spending time with whoever I can convince to come in and have a meal with me. And that allows me to create that personal bond, that personal relationship with people. I cannot cover everyone, but the point is, the effort has to be there. And when people see the effort, that translates into culture and they do it with other people beyond them. So I think the effort is something we have tried to retain. We have a very strong culture of town halls. Again, any location that I am, twice a year, we conduct town halls, which are in-person, face-to-face meetings. We just did that last evening in London. And that helps keep that startup, that personal attributes of the company, which I believe for us are very important.
Yes, I mean, when you're talking, I was thinking that actually, if I was to extend the model, I'd have startup, scale-up, growth, and then kind of stale oligopoly-type company, which is just sort of held in place in many cases in FS, sort of by regulation and momentum and things like that, because there are many chief executives of firms far smaller than yours who see themselves as just managing an organogram, you know, who don't actually get out and find enough time to see clients, who don't do town halls, who don't let somebody who joined yesterday ask them some question, and that kind of stuff. And again, that's something that can make one stale.
Absolutely, and maybe I do it to a fault, but I've been very careful not to fall in that trap. So today I don't have an office, I don't have a supporting team, I don't have an assistant. I just keep traveling and spending time in what I call the field. I probably overdo that, but it is my fear of being on the other extreme that drives me to make sure that I'm always spending time with clients, with staff, and really, you know, feeling the pulse of the organization firsthand, rather than, you know, I don't rely on reports, I don't rely on status reports, I don't rely on Excel sheets, I rely on meeting people, looking them in the eye, reading body language, reading between the lines, because that's where you really truly understand what's going on. And that's what leads to my crazy travel schedule, because with 20 countries, 7,000 staff, there is a limit of how long you can do that. But till now, I have not let go of that model. At some point, I will. But it's, for me, it's been crucial to growing Synchron and managing it to where we are today.
Yes, and it seems to me, I mean, we were talking before, I mean, my concern with doing these kind of things, you know, which is, oh, how did you get to be successful, is that people answer, oh, well, we recruit good staff, we have a good organisation, you know, it's all this kind of, we don't drink too much, we eat our cabbage, we go to bed early, we're nice to our mothers, which is all fine, but everyone tries to do that. But actually, I think one of the things you're highlighting here is almost, just to put words into your mouth, is that one of the risks in going from a scale-up to a bigger company is that you turn into a bureaucracy and you lose touch with the things that sort of made you young and fresh in the first place and got you to where you are. And so this is, you know, in a sense, I might label this as an anti-bureaucratization angle here to ensure that you don't get stale, but you remain fresh when you're growing.
That's a very good way of putting it. I believe very strongly in that. I think if somebody were to look at us from the outside, and many people have, they sometimes scratch their head of how could you run such a large organization the way you do. Sometimes somebody could use the word unstructured or perhaps even chaotic. I like to use the words dynamic and agile. Again, it is because I do not want to turn into just spending time doing internal meetings, analysis paralysis, and running the company on paper on status reports and lose the creativity.
Exactly. And as you say, because those end up being abstractions of the real.
Correct. And they misrepresent.
The real is actually the look in people's eyes and how they're feeling and what's actually going on. In large companies where the reports, at the top of the organization, having been at the top of a climb, I mean, it's 55,000 people under the Dresden, so I experienced enough of that then. You're only ever dealing with abstractions of abstractions.
Yes.
And that becomes very unreal. I mean, a chap I know, I won't say, is very senior at British Telecom, and I was in his office, and it was all ratios and numbers on the board. And I said, I won't mention his name, I said X, because I knew him well. I said, this is unreal, mate. You know, this is just like numbers, isn't it? So, well, at this level, what else can I do? Because it's such a vast, vast company. So at least you're keeping it real there. And I know fintechs, I won't mention names, of course, less than 100 staff or less than 200 staff, who I feel myself have already succumbed to bureaucratization.
Yes, I've seen
already succumbed to organogrammitis.
Yes.
Everyone's got a function, everyone's got a role and all that kind of stuff. So long before they've got 7,000 people, I mean, some of them haven't even got much beyond 70, they're really in danger of sliding down that stuff, of turning into an organogram. And one of the things that you skim over, of course, in your modesty, and again, I've seen this go wrong many times already, which is that it is a rare person. It's a very rare CEO, not being flattering, but it's a very rare CEO who has the skills to make a startup happen, who has the skills to make a scale-up happen, and has the skills to do growth. Quite often, I've seen around London people who are really good at getting a startup going. They create a buzz, they create a fuss, they create expectations, they get the whole thing going. But once they have to deal with a few reports and some processes and all that kind of thing, it sort of starts to grind to a halt. Now, that doesn't particularly matter if the individual concerned or the board of the firm have a grown-up conversation and say, do you know what, I'm not really enjoying this anymore. I preferred it being a startup. And they go up and set up another startup. How's your feeling about that?
Everybody's different, and I certainly have seen many cases of founders who haven't been able to make that journey. I've seen some, and all the famous startups, the founders have gone to that point where they've gone through a startup and become an established corporations like the Googles and the Facebooks and Ubers. So there are both sides of the extreme. I would like to still think that, even though you've been very kind with your comment about me, I think we're still in the early phases of our life cycle. Our ambitions are very large. We want to be a multi-billion dollar company. I think we're still in our infancy. So I'd still be modest in saying that I still have to prove myself in managing an organization that will be much larger than where we are today. At the same time, at least I would like to say that I'm very clear about my role in the company. The only reason I should be in the seat that I am today, which is the CEO seat, is not because I'm the largest shareholder or because I'm the lead founder or one of the three founders. It's because that I'm the one who can deliver the results. And the day that I feel that I'm not doing that anymore, or there's somebody else who can do it better than I can, then I don't have any issues in stepping aside and letting somebody else do it. I think many times startups fail to scale because the founders are too emotional about their role and they don't recognize their natural strengths and their weaknesses. And everybody's different. Some people can make that adjustment to think about scale and let go of the things that they were doing in the early days to others. Some people cannot. And if you're not, then you should be mature enough to say, okay, maybe now I hand over that responsibility to somebody else and keep doing what I'm good at. I would like to think that I'm very clear about my role. And if I continue to add value, I'll be in the chair. Otherwise, I'll look for somebody else.
Yes, and I can see that the ideal thing is that somebody can look themselves in the mirror and they're shaving one morning and they can say to themselves, shit, I'm not really enjoying this anymore.
Yeah.
I used to enjoy this.
Yes.
But now it's like a job.
Yes.
Not everybody can do that. Lots of people fall into the trap of it becoming an identity. Oh, I'm a CEO of a global company and I fly around and blah, 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 blah. And they get sucked into the identity. In which case, going back to wives, either if you're lucky, your wife says to you,
yes,
look, you're not enjoying that anymore. You're miserable all the time. Get another job.
Usually it's your spouse that spots it first.
Exactly. Yeah. The spouse. Or if the spouse isn't spotting it, or the husband not listening to the spouse, or the wife, I suppose, if it's the woman running the company, then you'd hope that the board can have that conversation. So again, it's a particular challenge.
Or friends.
Yes. It's really important. I mean, the whole world, we get given from a child this atomized idea that we're all atoms, but actually we all live as molecules. We're all connected in different ways, and we all rely on people to point out to us when we're not seeing things ourselves. So moving on a little bit here, the methods you grow. So you were three people originally, and now you're far more. So there's two types of methods. There's the organic growth, which is that you recruit people one at a time, and then the acquisitions, and you've obviously done a lot of both. So what's your thoughts around those?
I think we've been very, very high growth. Even today, we're growing at 25% year on year, which is top of the charts in our industry. So there must be something we're doing right. I think a few things that contribute to this is, one, we've been believers in both organic and inorganic growth. Not one or the other, but a combination of both. Majority of our growth comes from organic, investing in our sales and our marketing and our own business development. Two-thirds of our growth comes from that, but we've also been big believers in inorganic. We've acquired about 6 companies in the last 3 years. In total, about 25% of our company today has been built through acquisitions. 75% has been built organically. In addition to that, I think we have followed a model of having a simple strategy with incredible, excellent execution. So when it comes to execution, we, I think, do extremely well. I don't think our strategy is anything secret sauce or anything that is magical. It's a very simple business model, especially when it comes to consulting services, but it's the magic is in the execution. We have tried to make sure that early, like I said, we don't overmanage the company. We do have certain metrics that we track that are important to us, but they're not 100, they're not 50, they're not 20. It's maybe a handful, 4 to 5 metrics that are really key to our business that indicate to us how things are trending. And those metrics are known by everyone in the company, by all 7,000 people, and they're published. And we have a very transparent model when it comes to our financial numbers. A lot of companies I see are very secretive, very cagey about their books and their numbers. We're the extreme opposite. We talk about our growth, our revenue, our margins to everyone in the company, because that's how I feel I can align everybody to those goals. If I keep those secret, how do I align to the people? We've also, you know, in our fast growth, and this is what companies have to watch out, when you need a lot of talent to grow, there is a tendency to lower your requirements in terms of the talent that you're bringing on board. And that's something you should be very watchful of. If you do that, I think that puts you down a path of losing your edge. You have to be very, very careful in the talent you pick. You may feel that to scale, you can no longer have the same bar that earlier you had. But to compensate for that, you should have a very strong internal training program that is able to bridge that gap that may exist when people come in. So those are some of the things that I think have been crucial to allowing us to grow to where we are. How we manage the company, believe in inorganic growth, how we continue to take an incredible number of people every month, every year, and still meet our quality criteria.
Yes, and it's the subject of, you know, a whole podcast on its own or a whole series, how one makes acquisitions work. Because again, you know, reading between the lines and comparing your stories to others, you've done many acquisitions, and last time I saw statistics was donkey's years ago, but I think it was roughly more than 50% of M&As fail.
Yeah.
And, you know, having been at the Dresden Bank myself, whenever it was 15 years ago, I can't actually say that that was good for the firm. It was good for the shareholders. The client sold out at a good price, but in the end, it ended up, in a sense, killing the spirit of the thing that it bought. Now, that wasn't a unique story, because all the merchant banks, pretty much apart from Rothschilds, are still going, got acquired by European clearing banks, and it all went the same way in investment banking, blah-de-blah-de-blah-de. But just skimming over this, because I say it is a massive topic, does anything leap out to you, Faisal, about making acquisitions work and not killing the thing you bought? You buy something for a certain reason and then somehow you end up killing it because you've, you know, brought it, quotes, into your culture.
Yeah.
You could talk for hours on this, I'm sure, because again, without philandering, you guys must have really mastered this the hard way, because sometimes you might have got it right and sometimes not so right, and then you learn over time, you know.
Now, this one I will take a little bit of credit, because I think we have done this very successfully. I think it all starts from screening, you know, the potential acquisition. How well it fits into your business model and your strategy is one part, but how well it fits into your existing culture is another big topic. I think a lot of decisions, acquisition decisions, are made solely on the basis of a business fit without proper thought on how they fit culturally. And there are acquisitions that we wanted to do, which were great business fits for us, but we just felt that the culture was just not compatible, and we didn't do those. So the first point is, how you screen and how you make that decision to do the acquisition or not is very important. I think it all starts from there. If you do decide to go forward and acquire the firm and they agree to be acquired by you, I think how we have approached those firms has also been very unique. We are very respectful, we're very warm, and we follow an approach that is not overly aggressive in terms of integration. We give them the room, the time to settle in into the new world and not shake things up very quickly. So our integration process is usually, in these days, 12 to 18 months. After we do the deal, after we acquire, we say to them, please continue doing what you're doing. If there's any way we can come in and we can help you do your business better, we're always here. Otherwise, we'll just spend the next 3 to 6 months knowing each other, learning each other, and then start integrating from there. The other point I would like to make is that we always make sure that we have places for the principals and the founders of those acquired companies at a group level. And I think that's very, very key, is when the staff of an acquired company sees their leaders take on new group level, or what I call group level roles, executive roles, that makes them really feel that, yes, we are equal partners, we are equal members of this new company that we have joined, because our leaders have gotten big portfolios.
And presumably at that point, they can actually enhance your company's DNA. Rather than
Absolutely.
Being the Borg, you assimilate something and you turn them into a Borg.
It is a new DNA.
You bring some people in who have got a different perspective on the world and different skill sets and all that kind of stuff, and they can put some DNA into your firm.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And we say that very openly to the people within Synchron and the new people that are coming in, is we are here to create a new culture, a new DNA. We're not going to push our DNA on you, and we're not going to adopt your DNA completely. We'll take the best of both worlds and come up with something new.
Yeah, so just to try and sort of summarize that, of course it's a good answer, because you're doing it well. I mean, who am I to say that? But I was thinking, in the question, if someone was to say to me, what's the secret of a good marriage? Well, actually, that's a bit of a tougher one. We could do a few podcasts on that and probably never get there. But actually, well, one of the things we can say based on this is, well, have a good dating process beforehand.
Yes.
You know, marry somebody who's pre-qualified for both partners really, really very well, and where there is a cultural fit.
Yeah. Yes.
And that doesn't happen enough. As you say, quite often things are done for financial reasons. And again, going back to Dresdner and Kleinwortz, I remember we had some cultural training, which was very novel in the 1990s, and it was all sort of, this is what Germans are like, this is what sort of British people are like. It's actually, it's kind of, in a way, kind of racist, actually, but it's quite funny. But my heart sank, because the key point, one of the points was, you know, of course, nobody's culture was right and nobody was wrong. It's all this kind of liberal stuff. But one of them was, oh, yes, well, actually, you know, sort of Englishy merchant banking people are actually, they get on and do stuff. They make a decision, they turn left. If it's wrong, a bit later, they'll correct it and that kind of stuff there. And I think the polite phrase for that was post-planning. Whereas German culture, German commercial banking culture was pre-planning. I thought, oh dear, that's the entire opposite.
Yeah.
And you know, you can never marry those two together. Because either you're entrepreneurial and make things happen, we're going to change the world this afternoon, we'll sort it out tomorrow if it's not quite right, you know, or you take the opposite thing where you think about it for 6 months and you know, don't. So anyway, so fascinating. So we could talk forever on these things, Faisal, because you have had an amazingly successful 16-year journey. I like the way that you're staying young as a company and keeping in touch with startup mentality. I like your modesty in terms of that you haven't got very far yet. So maybe you can come back on the show and you're not 7,000 people, but 70,000 people. And we can talk then about the next phase change. But before we wrap up the show and maybe just dive a little bit more into Synchron, I'd like to thank my listeners, as always. Thanks to all of you around the world in 165 countries. And I know I can't talk to somebody who's not there, but I'd love somebody to listen in Greenland because there's a big space on the map and the Mercator projection ruins it for me. So anybody who's not listening in Greenland, please listen. I'd also like to thank my brand partners for the podcast, Archover, smart, simple and transparent P2P business lending. Loans up to £3 million for SMEs, delivering up to 7% secured and insured returns to lenders. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. And I better get this one right. And Synchron, digital business consulting and technology services for top-tier FS. From startup to 7,000 people, 18 countries, and $400 million of revenue. So I say that every other week, Faisal. Maybe just helpful, just this last section, if you just dive a little bit more into what digital business consulting and technology services means. There are 4,000 people out there, even if one in 100 of them could be your client who hasn't heard of you. What actually do you sell to who?
Thank you. So Synchron is a global consulting firm that provides digital services, business consulting, and technology services in 20 countries around the world. Our digital services are focused on a few areas. First is user experience, what we call our interactive capability, where we do a lot of design, whether it is on the desktop or mobile. That's a very hot area for us because these days with everything on your mobile and in a very easy to use way, clients are expecting the same type of experience to be delivered to their end users. So our digital services comprise of user experience, but also emerging technology capabilities like blockchain and artificial intelligence. Blockchain is a revolutionary technology that will take its time to get into the mainstream, but when it does, I think it will completely transform how business is done today, whether it is how trade finance operates, how trade settlement works, how payments are done across the world. It will have a dramatic impact. And perhaps one of the most exciting areas that we are working on is artificial intelligence with the advent of new ways of doing data science, machine learning, robotics, natural language processing, conversational AIs. This has the potential of, again, dramatically changing, one, the end user interaction. So no longer will we be required to be on a laptop or on a mobile. We can just simply speak and get our things done. To robotic solutions where a lot of the middle and back office operations that require a lot of humans can be replaced by machine and software. Of course, that has separate social impacts, but that's a separate topic. So our digital capabilities are very strong and in those areas. The second area that we work a lot in is business consulting services, which are targeted these days largely to reg compliance, risk, finance, and large-scale change management engagements that we do for our clients. So we all know the mountain of reg work that banks need to do, whether it is Basel or Dodd-Frank or Volcker or BCBS 239, whatever it may be. This requires a lot of subject matter expertise, which is something that we have been growing for the last few years and we are very strong at. The third part, which is probably the biggest, is our technology services for our client. Within this, we have our systems integration capability where we implement, run, and maintain packages such as Murex and Calypso and others to our custom development capabilities where we custom build next generation technology systems and also run and maintain and also manage the end of life process for technology systems for our clients. So in general, this is the work that we do, specifically targeted for financial services, banking, and insurance.
And I saw something that you work with, I've forgotten, X percent of Fortune 500 companies around the world.
Yes, we work with about 70% of the top Western banks in the world.
So the marketing task gets ever harder because once you run out of the list.
Yes, we'll come up with something new.
You've got to invent a bank so you can go and work for it. And one thing I think it's sometimes hard for the listeners to get a feel for is the size of projects. I mean, I talk to all scales of firms. I mean, Accenture have been on the firm and they famously do multi-billion pound things for the government in the UK, which sometimes work out okay. Not always.
No comment.
Yes, exactly. Well, it's the civil services fault, I'm sure. But what kind of range from smallest to largest projects do you do if there are people out there in a bank and they're feeling the frustrations that you felt 15 years ago because those haven't been eliminated around the world entirely yet? What's a kind of typically a small project and what's a typically a large project? What kind of sums of money are we talking about?
I think from a small project, we can engage, especially in our digital innovation areas, we engage anything from $200,000 perhaps, a few months project. Our largest projects would probably be $250 million today, multi-year engagements on the technology side. So that's really the range we operate in today.
Excellent. Well, time's shot by, as always, Faisal, and I think we've managed to dig out some of the precious nuggets about how to be successful in growth. I don't think we've written the textbook on, but there's quite a lot of ideas out there. It's not necessarily even really started in fintech yet. We were talking about the acquisition, and I was thinking, you know, one of the prime examples is perhaps Funding Circle. They did an acquisition last year. Press is very positive, of course, largely because it's sort of somewhat incestuous in terms of conferences and journalism and all that kind of thing. But I'm sure Funding Circle, for example, hopes the next one goes better. I mean, this one's probably going okay. But the head of Germany, the German business, which is the largest part of it, they acquired, left after a couple of months. And then I read recently that sort of they stopped doing business in Spain. So it's a really important topic that we've discussed here. And thank you for sharing your wisdom, because if these fintechs in London are going to get anywhere, they're going to have to scale up, they're going to have to go into other countries, and they're going to be facing all the sort of challenges that you face, Faisal. So if one day you wake up in the morning and your wife's saying, time to get another job, I think you can be an integration and acquisition M&A specialist, because there's a lot of demand for that out there. Or maybe Synchron can grow another limb and do that in fintech. So thank you very much. It's been most fascinating, and it's always interesting to find out how people far down the track from me have got where they have. So thank you for that, Faisal.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory/non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight dance.